As she had since she realized that Kimura was alive and hunting for her, Laura Kinney ran. If you wanted to get sufficiently metaphorical, she'd been running from Kimura, or at least Kimura's legacy, all her life. The difference being that this time she was running toward something, though, of course, her pursuer did not know that. As she ran, she heard the rasping voice of one of her many mentors, dispensing out-of-context but unbeatable wisdom from a corner of her memory.
Few people understand the psychology of dealing with a highway traffic cop. Your normal speeder will panic and immediately pull over to the side. This is wrong. It arouses contempt in the cop heart. Make the bastard chase you. He will follow.
She rounded a corner, nearly skidding out on the damp pavement despite the sturdy lugged soles of her tactical boots, caught herself on the opposite wall, and sprinted down the adjoining alley, hurdling a cluster of trash cans as she went. She was cutting across the corner of Hell's Kitchen, taking the direct route from Salutown to City Center and bypassing Claremont entirely. Unconsciously, she counted the seconds until she heard the crash of Kimura plowing through those same trash cans, knowing the facility's old enforcer wouldn't bother to avoid them. 7 seconds. Not much of a lead, but enough.
"Every foot you make me run is another minute you'll wish I hadn't left you alive," Kimura bellowed from somewhere behind her.
That does not even make sense, does it? Laura thought abstractly. She let the question drop and swarmed over a section of chain-link fence dividing the alley, then slammed through a fire door and into the basement of a building on the unofficial kitchen center boundary line. She took the stairs in a single long leap, rolling and springing up at the bottom, dogleg left, yanked open a metal service door, and bolted into the utilities tunnel beyond. She'd rehearsed this route in the IPO's danger room number 5 all day, until the path was as familiar to her as the way from the southeast corner bedroom of Victor Creed's country house to the dojo in the back garden. As familiar as the well-worn data track that was the only message she'd ever had from her mother. "You are my daughter, and I love you." Through the steam tunnel, up the slope, second branch on the right, putting on a little more speed now, objective in sight. Kimura was committed now. Even if Laura got out of her line of sight, there was only one place she would emerge. Only one place she could emerge. Squarely in the jaws of Griffin's trap. Laura smiled as she crashed through the last of the panic-barred doors and into the darkness beyond. 1984 Weisman Avenue, New Avalon. Griffin strode briskly through the double doors at the end of the corridor from the Zeppelin dock elevator, his face all business. The room he entered was already coming to life, its regular staff at their posts. Jeff Depew had arrived before him to coordinate the opening stages. The rest of his team, Griffin knew, were already scattered at key positions around the operation area, along with the Titans and half a dozen of the IPO's other heavy hitters. All had strict instructions not to provide backup. They were here to keep the situation contained, period. The chief's word and honor were involved. He had made a private promise, though, that if Kimura won the contest that was about to happen, she would have precious little time to savor her triumph. "She's here," Jeff reported. "Confirmed, sir," one of the white-suited technicians reported from his station at the master situation display. "Two signatures. Second one's just entering the zone now." Griffin nodded. "Initiate lockdown and run program." "Roger," the technician replied, his hands moving deftly over the controls. "Containment fields are online. Sector secured." Outside, visible through the panoramic windows of the control room, a holographic sky rezzed into life above a war-torn cityscape. From hidden PA speakers, the complex resounded with a synthetic voice announcing the facility's name. Satisfied with his readouts, the tech turned to Griffin and reported firmly, "The Battledrome is live." New Avalon Battledrome, main fighting floor. Urban apocalypse scenario loaded. Kimura was understandably disoriented to emerge from a service tunnel which she had entered from a crisp fall afternoon in New Avalon, to find herself in a twilit, shattered, deserted urban hell, beneath a sky illuminated by the baleful blood-red glow of distant fires on an overcast night. Hot winds scented with burning wood and melted metal brushed past her. She turned, thinking to reopen the bulkhead she'd come out of, but her hand slid off the frictionless resistance of a force field instead of grasping the handle. "What the hell?" she muttered. Then, turning back to face the ruined streetscape that had confronted her, she shouted, "Do you really think even this can help you, clone? Do you think you can run from me forever?" "No," X-23's voice replied from above her. Looking up, Kimura saw her quarry crouching like a gargoyle on the cornice of the half-ruined building opposite. In the heat of this place, she'd discarded the black leather jacket she'd been wearing in the square. Above her midnight blue tactical trousers, she wore only a black t-shirt marked with the stark white logo of an old Earth band. Laura felt the familiar twinges of pain as her claws shot through the backs of her hands. Skuld hadn't had time yet to keep her promise of repairing that small design flaw. Truth be told, she didn't really mind. She'd never minded that particular pain. In her darkest times, it had served a useful purpose. It reminded her that she was alive. And right now, it reminded her of, well, everything else. "I am done running," she said, and went to war. Kimura met her attack with contempt at first, as she always had. She made her usual speech about how pointless the effort was, how useless X-23's weapons were against her, how much she was going to suffer for her resistance this time. And indeed, Laura's claws did seem to have no measurable effect on Kimura's uniform or skin, just as always. In the control room, Jeff watched the opening of the fight, the ever-detached observer in the back of his mind noting the wide range and excellent execution of Laura's technique, Kimura's contrasting relative lack of skill, and the ever-increasingly evident fact that it wasn't making any difference. "This isn't working," he mused under his breath. "Wait for it," Griffin told him, a note of grim satisfaction in his voice. Jeff darted a sidelong glance at his boss, unwilling to take his eyes off the fight for more than an instant. Griffin's own gaze was riveted on the battle, but he didn't seem worried. Jeff wondered what the man was seeing that he was missing himself, and then he thought he might have seen it. At first sight, it seemed that Kimura's invincibility had naturally enough given her the upper hand. True, Laura hadn't been almost instantly rendered helpless, as in all their previous clashes. She had gotten much better at avoiding the worst of her old foe's onslaught. Instead of charging blindly in, fueled by panic and rage, and constantly destined to take the worst of every exchange, she was fighting tactically, using position and mobility to avoid taking serious damage. That did mean, however, that Kimura was constantly keeping her on the run, and before long she'd been forced into one of the half-ruined buildings lining the street. It seemed to have been an office building in its previous life. The ground floor was a cavernous lobby, not unlike that in the morning's tactical simulation, full of columns and crumbling marble panels that had once been quite grand. Here, Laura changed up her strategy and made oblique pass after oblique pass, coming at Kimura from every angle and trying again and again to score a solid hit. All her efforts seemed to come to nothing, though. More often than not, she missed outright, her blades ripping through marble and concrete instead of even glancing uselessly off her enemy's body. By this time, Kimura had gotten over being thrown off by how much the clone had grown, not just physically but mentally, while she had been in the deep freeze. She might be a grown woman now, and a confident one, moving with an assured grace that was all at odds with the frantic, panic-driven slashing of their old sessions, but she was still doing no harm at all, and she was still going to lose. "You're pathetic, clone," Kimura said scornfully after X-23's 11th or 12th failed pass. "You've been flailing around in here forever. You haven't even hit me more than once or twice, much less cut me." Laura gave her an ice-cold smile. I was not trying to cut you, she said, and then faded back through the doorway behind her into the street. Scowling in puzzled annoyance, Kimura moved to pursue. The building around her groaned, shifted, and then, its supporting columns methodically weakened one by one over the last few minutes, collapsed. In the control room, Griffin smiled a cold smile of his own. You never studied, he murmured. Kimura pulled herself free of the wreckage, coughing clouds of dust, and staggered upright. She took a moment to collect herself, shaking her head and waiting for her ears to stop ringing. Then, as fury replaced confusion, she bellowed, You're dead, clone! Do you hear me? Dead! You said that 75 years ago, Laura replied from her perch atop a mailbox on the far side of the street corner. I am still alive. With a wordless cry of rage, Kimura flung herself off the rubble pile and toward her quarry. Round 2. Years before, one of the many teacher figures who had passed through Laura Kinney's life had warned her against a tendency to fixate exclusively on the most obvious weapons with which the facility had equipped her. Claws, poor substitute for brains, was actually the phrase Miyagi-sensei had used, usually while avoiding her fastest strikes and causing her to fall out of boats into icy mountain lakes. It was one of the hardest lessons for her to take on board, since the blades were so much a part of who she was, but she had always at least tried to bear it in mind ever since. Now, faced with their evident continued uselessness against this foe, she called those lessons and others back to mind and started using other items from her toolbox. Kimura's condition after the building's collapse showed that, while her skin was functionally unbreakable, what was within it was merely very tough. Rather than keep trying to cut her, Laura decided to shift gears and see how far she could get by piling up blunt force trauma. It shortly became clear that this was not the best plan, though, because of the problem of reach. Even full-grown, Laura was not a particularly tall woman. Her principal genetic template had been short for a man, and her mother's contribution had not helped the situation much. Kimura remained at least a couple of inches taller, and in short order she capitalized on Laura's tactical switch by doing exactly what Laura didn't want her to do, in getting first one, then both, hands on her. That seemed to rekindle the cocky spark she'd been missing since the building had come down on her. Dragging her smaller quarry close, she smirked into Laura's face and said, Hey, clone, you know what I've really missed? That great sound your skull makes when I crack it. She had just enough time to wonder, before her headbutt connected, why that remark made the clone smile slightly. Then it did connect, and rebounded with a dull metallic whang, hard enough to make her see stars and lose her grip on X-23's shoulders. What the... she blurted, but before she could recover her wits enough to comment further, Laura had, as conversational protocol demanded, hauled off and headbutted her back even harder, sending Kimura sprawling on her back in the street. On a high rooftop 2 simulated city blocks east, Virginia Shepherd lay in a prone sniping position, observing the situation through the telesight of her custom Valkyrie anti-materiel rifle, George. As Kimura fell, Shepherd nudged her partner with an elbow and said delightedly, She speaks Tuchankan. Like a native, Garrus Vakarian agreed, keeping his eye glued to his spotter scope. Kimura was only out for half a second or so, not even long enough to know she'd been unconscious. As she got back to her feet, she spied a glint of metal under the blood on X-23's forehead before the wound disappeared. Laura reached up, wiped the blood from her face with one hand, and casually flicked it to the ground. This is pointless, she said. Rice is dead. Largo is dead. Genom, as you knew it, is dead. Your continued pursuit of me serves no purpose. The galaxy turns. History has moved on. She made a general gesture of out there with her bloody hand. I am giving you one chance. Walk away. Kimura stared at her in utter disbelief, unable to even form words for a few seconds. Then she burst out laughing. You really don't get it, do you, clone? She said. It's not about Rice, or Largo, or Genom. It's about me and you knowing your place, and me putting you in it. That's it. That's all there is. Laura gazed silently at her for a moment, then assumed a ready stance. Then it seems we have no choice but to finish this. Kimura cracked her knuckles, smirking. That's the only time in your miserable life you're ever going to be right about anything, she said, and waited in for round three. Laura seemed to have turned a corner now, knowing firsthand that Kimura could be hurt, and having had her one extraordinary overture rebuffed, she met her enemy's charge head-on. Before long her fists were bloody, the soft tissues abraded away by repeated impacts with Kimura's steel-hard skin, but she kept punching anyway. In all their previous battles, Kimura had been able to win almost instantly by exploiting a combination of Laura's tendency to panic when facing her and her inability to prosecute an effective defense with all her arms and legs broken. Now both those advantages were gone. Even so, the balance seemed to remain on Kimura's side. Laura was by far the better fighter, but try as she might, brilliant as she might be, she still had no real answer for Kimura's durability. The punches, kicks, and throws hurt her, but didn't really injure her, and without giving her foe time to recover, Laura wasn't giving herself time to recover either. Enough! Kimura snarled, dealing Laura the kind of punch that would have broken five of her ribs the day before and still sent her sprawling and gasping for air. Rolling a crick out of her neck, the enforcer remarked, I have to give it to you, clone. You put up a good fight this time, but you still can't win. You never could. She sneered. Kinney made you weak. I always told Rice he should have let me deal with her, but no, he had to leave it to the last minute. Laura pulled herself slowly to her feet, fixed Kimura with an intent stare, and said quietly, Say that again. What, you didn't know? Kimura replied. I caught her on the way out the door while you and your boyfriend were taking out the security department. She grinned cruelly. Not the hardest job I've ever been given, but after beating you to a paste every couple of weeks for 10 years, it might have been the most satisfying. In the official Experts of Justice report on the incident, the sound Laura made in response to this intelligence defied transcription. It is recorded simply as, brackets, scream, close brackets. Faster than the observer's eyes could follow, she hurled herself across the space between them, her claws like streaks of lightning. They seemed to come at Kimura from all angles, as though her attacker had become legion. She disappeared briefly in a welter of glittering blades, flying sparks, and flecks of blood, caught completely wrong-footed by the sudden onslaught. Her nervous system lit up with a sensation so completely unfamiliar that it took her a few moments to identify it as pain. Roaring with rage, she counterattacked, seizing her assailant by the throat and hurling her with all her strength across the street. Laura hit the wall of the opposite building hard enough to depress the bricks behind her, then toppled forward in a cloud of mortar dust and sprawled face down on the sidewalk, hacking and coughing through a partially crushed larynx. She stayed there for a couple of seconds, letting her airway regenerate, and then dragged herself to her feet. The blow had erased the red mist from her mind, replacing it with a sort of crystalline hyper-clarity that she'd felt only a few times in her long life. The fury was still there, and the gnawing hunger for revenge, but instead of blotting out her conscious mind, they now accelerated it. As if in slow motion, she saw Kimura charging across the street toward her, her head, shoulders, and arms covered in a fine network of shallow, oozing cuts, screaming, What the hell did you do? As deliberately as though she had all the time in the world, she retracted all but her right foreclaw and felt it become the center of the entire universe. The syllables of the Ryozan Oath of Total Commitment, which she had once learned from a black-clad holy man on some forgotten world beyond the rim, sprang spontaneously to her mind and fell in a growing whisper from her lips as the moment shrank to a singularity. Gimu Giru Gan Gogufo. Having thus pledged all that dwelt within her to the pursuit of this one goal, whatever the cost, Laura moved, meeting Kimura's charge with a tiger spring. Her blood afire, eyes blazing, single unsheathed blade shining torch-like under the battledrome's blood-red sky, she cried the last word of the oath, the one that bound her very life to the success or failure of the effort, at the top of her voice from a throat still raw and bleeding. Vitas! The collision resounded in her metallized bones, felt like it had nearly jarred her very soul clean out of her body. Kimura's fist skittered across unbreakable ribs, tearing Laura's shirt and the skin beneath, the partially deflected impact still displacing soft parts beyond. At the same instant, the knuckles of Laura's right fist struck Kimura's forehead, sending a recoil shock up her arm that nearly dislocated her shoulder. For a full second, they stood there, leaning together like the halves of an arch, Laura's fist against Kimura's forehead, the enforcer's eyes rolling upward as if to look at it. Then, with a soft metallic sound, Laura withdrew her blade, staggered one step to the right, and fell on her side to the ground, her heart no longer beating. Kimura stood where she was a moment longer as blood began to flow from the neat vertical slot in the center of her forehead. Then she pitched backward and sprawled full length on the pavement, and all was silent in the battledrome. Nearly a full minute passed before Laura stirred, then drew a deep, ragged breath. A moment later she took another, then pulled herself to hands and knees, wincing as she felt her various internal organs move back to their accustomed places. Lightheaded with pain and fatigue, she opened her eyes and saw her arch foe, already being zipped into a body bag by a couple of IPO blue suitors. A pair of deep brown boots came to a stop in front of her, and a familiar voice said, "My dear, allow me to give you a hand and declare you today's, if you'll pardon the expression, victor." She looked up, neck protesting a little, and actually smiled a bit at the sight of Victor Creed, holding her jacket in one hand and offering the other. She took it and let him help her to her feet, then took back her jacket and shrugged it on. A small crowd was forming around the battle zone now, as all the experts of justice who had observed the fight left their posts and congregated like specters at a car crash. Most of them she recognized from the briefing earlier that afternoon. One she recognized from an entirely different place, the files on her own creation. So unexpected was his appearance here that, as he emerged from the little crowd that was gathering and approached, Laura could only stare at him. She felt her body draw very slightly into a reflexive, defensive crouch, her claws shifting within her arms, but not quite deploying. "Relax, kid," said Logan with a wry little smile. He held up his wrist, displayed his lens to her, and added, "It ain't what you're thinking." "Lensman Logan is a very good friend," Victor told her. "Not at all like the late, unlamented gentleman he so unfortunately resembles." Laura eyed him. "You're not?" she asked, leaving the rest of the question unvoiced. Logan shook his head. "Nah," he said, and then, as though it were the simplest explanation in the world, "parallel universe." He stood for a moment and watched the blue suitors cart away Kimura's earthly remains, then turned back to Laura and said, "Not bad work, kid. You got potential. Beer?" She looked at the tin of Kirin Ichiban he was holding out to her, reflected that Mortal Kombat was after all very thirsty work, and accepted it with quiet thanks. Even after the surreal whirlwind this day had been, she had to smile slightly at the exasperated look Victor gave Logan at this point. He was a dear, dear man, Sir Victor Creed, but he did have a tendency to still think of her as 15 years old. Griffin appeared then, having supervised the removal of the body, given the circumstances, not bound for the regular city mortuary. He thanked the assembled experts for their help in providing coverage for the operation, and told them to consider themselves at liberty. When the whole crowd of them emerged onto the sidewalk in front of the Battledrome's main entrance, night had fully fallen, and the city center thrummed with light and activity. Laura finished the beer Logan had given her, tossed the tin expertly into the nearest city rubbish bin, and then turned to the others.
"I am not very good with words," she said haltingly, "but thank you, all of you. I could not have succeeded tonight without your help. But thank you also for not helping too much."
With expressions of welcome, gestures of friendly camaraderie, and even the occasional fist bump for her, most of the experts dispersed, leaving only Griffin and Skuld standing by the Battledrome entrance with Laura, and Victor and Logan a little way off. Griffin, hands in his pockets, gave her a questioning look. "What now?" he asked.
"I do not know," Laura replied.
"Well," Griffin gestured around with exaggerated casualness, "you're welcome to stick around here for a while. No pressure," he added. "Just an open door."
"Thank you," Laura said.
Then, hesitating, she went on,
"I have much to consider."
She seemed to consider something for a moment, then hugged him.
"For right now, chiren ayer."
Bidding the others good evening, she turned and started walking off toward the end station on the corner.
"She's going to fade," Skuld predicted by lens. "Thinks she has to. She's been doing the wandering samurai thing too long."
"Maybe, maybe not," Griffin replied with a private smile. Skuld, looking puzzled, followed his eyeline and saw a figure in a long yellow coat darting to intercept Laura's path to the subway. "Hey," said Jubilation Lee cheerfully, "you're not taking off, are you?" While Laura was considering how to reply to that, she went on, "Listen, you're like really old buds with the chief, right?"
"In a manner of speaking,"
Laura replied, unsure where this conversation was going.
"Yeah, so you're not going anywhere, girlfriend," said Jubilee, throwing an arm around her shoulders. "I need intel."
"Not from me, mind," she continued as she led Laura back in the other direction. "I mean, I love the guy to bits, but NITW, you dig? It's for my roomie. She's got it super bad for him, but she's so hella shy she can't even talk to him, except about work, until about her fifth drink. And by fifth, I mean 25.6 fluid ounces. I'm hoping you can find her an angle, because right now the whole thing is just sad."
Laura blinked at this onslaught, managing to reply only,
What?
Jubilee grinned. "What you need is a quick trip to Dr. Jubilee's social wellness clinic, my friend. I'll have you au courant with all the latest around here by the time they chuck us out of McLeary's tonight," she added expansively.
"Miss Lee," Victor put in as they reached him.
Jubilee paused.
"Yes, man who looks terrifyingly like Sabretooth as Sherlock Holmes."
Victor was momentarily taken aback, then soldiered on.
Yes.
Withdrawing a card from his inside pocket, he handed it to her with a flourish and said,
"Do present this item to the proprietor with my compliments. Enjoy your evening. Try not to kill anyone undeserving."
"Words I live by, man," said Jubilee breezily. "Good night, everybody. Don't worry. Everything is under control." Skuld stood and watched them walk away uptown, then turned to the others and asked rhetorically,
"Why do I feel like we've just witnessed one of those Butch meets Sundance moments that should have been prevented?"
Smiling, Logan lit a cigar.
"Story of my flamin' life, darling," he said.
At the corner, just before Jubilee shepherded her around it, Laura paused and looked back, making momentary, questioning eye contact with Griffin. He grinned and made a "go on with you then" gesture, and then they were gone.
They grow up so fast, he sighed, then turned and started walking toward the end station himself. Who's for Toskies? Airy Productions Unlimited, Flying Yak Studios, and Bacon Comics Group, in association with the International Police Organization and Avalon Broadcasting System, presented Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Weapon of Choice, A Lensman, the Brave and the Bold Special Event, written, directed, and read by Benjamin D. Hutchins, hi, with Jeff Depew, in consultation with Chris Pinard and the rest of the Airy Productions' usual suspects. X-23 created by Craig Kyle. Bacon Comics Chief Derek Bacon. Laura Kinney will return.